Welcome to Integrated. This is the podcast where we seek to bridge the gap between the intellect and the will so that we can grow as disciples of Christ, surrendering all that we are and all that we have to the truth. Hey guys, welcome back to Integrated. My name is Angela Erickson, and I'm so glad that you are here today with me and Pamela Acker. That was a huge interview. A lot of you guys loved that interview, and I was so excited to have a chance to bring her back on. Beth, thanks for coming on. She's already excited for this interview. It's going to be a good one. And we have a lot to talk about, but before we get started, of course, please like, share, and subscribe. Do all of those things. And if you've been liking the podcast, I think I've been getting quite a few new viewers to this podcast, and or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or whatever, please review it. Like that actually, that just helps so much for other people to find this podcast. And I think I've been covering a lot of really amazing things, having amazing guests on, and there's definitely more to come. So please make sure other people can find this podcast too. That helps me out a ton. So today we're going to sit down with Pamela Acker. She helps do work for the Colby Institute. I think I have a link in the description. If I don't, then please go. I will make sure that you also are able to find, hold on, I have a kiddo that is trying to get my attention right now. Yes, Paige. We're fighting over the movie. This is what happens when I do a live show. The kids are, they're going to be coming in and out. Nope. I already told you guys John gets to pick the movie. All right. Shut the door. Thank you. Bye. I know. I'm not changing my mind. It's John's turn. Everyone's fighting over the 2 minutes in. I know Margo's like 2 minutes in. I know. I don't want to lock the door, you know, so they just get free reign. You know, we just live in a circus here. But anyway, I said we have awesome interviews coming up here. Like, I think I'm going to be talking to somebody about integrated health in the next episode. Then I'm going to be shifting gears and talking with Kennedy Hall about some of the more fundy Catholicism that has been problematic in some traditional circles of Catholicism as of late, and some other really great interviews coming up in the future. So, yes, Claire's also really excited to see Pamela Acker live. Yes. Okay. So I was saying that she does work for the Colby Institute, and you need to go support them so that she continues to have a job along with all the other people there doing just like amazing work. Just shedding light on God's creation and science and the fact that there's no separation between the two. God is the creator of the universe. And so, anyway, they're doing really amazing work, and I'm so excited to have her back on to talk about COVID, really. I mean, I phrase it as COVID being hindsight is 2020. It was my little plan where it's just try and get under the radar, I think, a little bit, honestly, a little bit more vague, but it really is in a double entendre for what we're looking at. So many of us are looking back and saying, what on earth happened? And so I think you're the perfect person to talk to about it. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Well, so when you look back on it, like, what are the first things that you think of? Because we had a new vaccine technology. We talked a little bit about the mechanisms of how vaccines work in the last episode. So if this is part two, if you haven't watched part one, go back after this interview and definitely watch it if you want a better understanding of how vaccines work to begin with, like normal vaccines. But then COVID happened and we started using a new type of vaccine in mass. Would you mind talking about mRNA vaccines and kind of what's different about the makeup of those?
Sure. So what comes as a surprise, I think, to a lot of people is that the technology that was deployed with the new vaccine, I'll try not to say the C word too many times so you hopefully don't get another strike on YouTube.
I was telling Pamela, I did get a little bit of a warning. I got a slap on the wrist from YouTube. It was when I tried making shorts out of our interview that they,
oh, that's funny.
They got
okay.
me.
Yeah. Then it became more obvious. All right. So the mRNA technology to try to basically turn your body into the vaccine manufacturer has been around for a lot longer than people realize. And it's funny because I remember reading articles or seeing YouTube videos that talked about, oh, this technology, it's been around for a long time. It's been here for decades. And so it's not new and therefore it's not dangerous. But because I'm a researcher, that it's been here for decades, but we don't have a functional vaccine using it yet, really triggered a red flag for me. Because that means that we've been trying to make a vaccine using this technology for about 3 decades and it hasn't worked yet. And that means it hasn't gotten to the point even where we're doing probably a clinical trial in human beings. There may have been a few phase 1 clinical trials, but we're not like a phase 3 clinical trial where we're actually recruiting tens of thousands of people or thousands of people you know, to take this and see if they're being protected from the disease we're trying to protect from. So the basic idea behind an mRNA vaccine is there's two things that generally make it beneficial to the vaccine industry. One is that because mRNA is a relatively simple molecule, and it's funny because this ties into the history of science a little bit here, because people used to think that proteins were the information carrying molecule in the cell because DNA was just too simple, because it was always just this double helix and it only had four different letters that you could work with, four different
A, T, C, and D?
G.
G, close, yes, though. Close. Ah, man.
You got at least a C. So it's only got four letters. So how can this be the information carrying molecule in the cell? And it was experiments in the 50s that kind of started elucidating the fact that actually DNA is way more important than we thought it was. And then mRNA is just a single-stranded copy of DNA. So it's a simpler molecule, has a shorter lifespan. It's also a shorter molecule, because usually when you're making a messenger RNA, you're just copying a little bit of the DNA. So if you think about your cell, you can think of the nucleus as kind of like a library, right? And your DNA is a rare book. It's very important. It has all the information that you need from beginning of your life to the end of your life. And if you were a library, you wouldn't loan that out to your average high school student who wanted to write a research paper. You would maybe make a copy of a page or two that they actually needed and send them home with that copy. So you can think of mRNA like that. So it's a copy, a photocopy of a molecule that's very large and very, very expensive, in terms of there's only one in each cell and you definitely need it. It's very rare. It's very valuable, you know, but mRNA, you can make, you know, 10, 15, 100, 1,000 photocopies of one little section of that DNA, and that controls how much protein gets made in your cells. So you've got the same amount of DNA, the same type of DNA, the same messages in the DNA in every single cell in your body, but you get different copies made in different cells. You have different mRNAs, and that the number that you have at any given time and the ones that you have is going to determine what the fate of that cell is, whether it's an eye cell or a liver cell, whether that cell is growing or dying, whether that cell is dividing or staying single. You know, so mRNA is a really important cellular mechanism. So what the mRNA vaccines then tried to do was basically take that little messenger and insert it into your cell. So now that your cell is going to do something different, your cell is going to become a vaccine manufacturer. So instead of the vaccine, the company making a bunch of spike protein and then purifying that spike protein, which is a really laborious and time-consuming process, purifying proteins, and it's never 100% pure. And this is one of the problems we talked about, I think, last time, in terms of the aborted fetal DNA contaminants in vaccines that use aborted fetal cell lines, because you can never purify the virus particles completely out of the cellular debris, and you can never purify a vaccine completely from the cellular components that were used when you're manufacturing it. So, you know, the idea then would be that you've got, instead of having this super laborious, super time-consuming process, you just stick this little messenger into a person and they make the vaccine. And that makes it a whole lot easier on the manufacturer. And the other thing is that then if you get this technology perfected somehow, which I'm going to explain in a minute why we can't actually perfect it, but if you could get it perfected, then you could theoretically come up with a vaccine for literally anything, because all mm-hmm. you need is just a little sequence of mRNA that codes for not the spike protein, but say, you know, one of the proteins on a flu virus or one of the proteins on a diphtheria bacteria. So, you know, that there's a lot of appeal there, because they're saving a lot of time, a lot of labor, a lot of investment. And then if they get the platform going, it could be totally just, you know, easy, very easy to adapt to any disease just immediately.
So this doesn't even sound like a vaccine then. It's really some sort of genetic technology that rewrites the genome. Is that like how would you describe it? Because I know there's been a lot of debate about whether or not it is a vaccine.
Sure.
Would you say that it is a vaccine? Because the mechanism sounds totally different.
So it is and it isn't, right? Because if I were to take spike protein and inject that into you, the effect that it's going to have in your body is basically the same as if your body made the spike protein itself. You know, so technically we're taking a foreign protein and we're causing an immune reaction in your body. So the line gets blurred there in terms of whether it's a vaccine or not. I know a lot of people are going to come out and say it's absolutely not a vaccine. I would say it is both a vaccine and a gene therapy at the same time. Yeah. It is a vaccine that is gene therapy, or at least a you know, something along the lines of gene therapy, because there's some blurriness there too, and I'm not as familiar with that part. But it's actually important to understand that the mechanism, even though you're causing the person's body to make the spike protein, the mechanism whereby the spike protein is inducing an immune reaction is exactly the same as in a traditional vaccine.
That's a really great distinction because, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us are trying to wrap our heads around what this means in terms of scientific development and advancement. Mm-hmm. Is this, like you're saying, is this going to be the thing that we turn towards in the future? And is this the future of the vaccine program, I guess you could say?
Sure.
And we have a lot of concern. There are legitimately a lot of concerns about that. You brought up so many good points about, you know, if this has been in development for over 3 decades and they haven't even made it through a phase 3 trial, we should be really concerned about the fact that it was pushed, mandated in mass and pushed, and people were coerced into taking this thing in the military, mm-hmm. the government, and many, many jobs, many employers. I don't know, like, what are your biggest concerns about the impacts of these mRNA vaccines?
Well, you mentioned earlier this idea that can they change the genome, right? So normally we would think of information, if you're making a photocopy, you think of information flow in one direction. You go from the book to the photocopy to the report. And then, you know, that whatever happens to the photocopy doesn't really matter, right? But it doesn't actually just work in that one direction, because photocopies can sometimes be integrated into the book when you're talking about cells and you're talking about mRNA and you're talking about DNA. Now there's a particular protein called reverse transcriptase, which basically, when you make a copy of mRNA from the DNA, it's called transcription. So reverse transcriptase is the enzyme that does transcription in reverse. So it's basically the enzyme that'll take the mRNA, make a DNA copy of it, and integrate that, and then that can get integrated into the DNA.
Wow.
So so I actually used to work in vaccine development. I think we talked about that a little bit last time. And I, by God's providence, and much against my inclination, I got stuck on the HIV project because I was like, well, there's a really easy way to prevent HIV and it's not a vaccine. But that's something you need to talk to a different interviewee about, because
yeah. I probably will.
Too many flags in this one podcast, but there's a lot of ways to prevent HIV besides a vaccine, but HIV is an interesting virus because it uses the protein reverse transcriptase to get its DNA into the human DNA. So that's why you have such a long latent period with people who are HIV infected before they develop AIDS, because the virus is basically hiding itself in their genome. Those cells are then, you know, replicating, or they're traveling throughout the body or whatever. And then the virus kind of comes out of,
it starts to express itself once it's hit like a certain threshold.
Yeah. And you can actually just make viral copies kind of perpetually because it integrates into the genome in a way that allows it to do that. So you can have one infected cell kind of limping around. It doesn't die. It doesn't explode when all the viruses are made, like a lot of other cells will, or with a lot of other viruses, but the HIV can kind of like leak out a little bit of virus and a little bit of virus and a little bit of virus throughout the lifetime of the cell. So I did not know when at the beginning of 2020 that humans endogenously make reverse transcriptase. That means we naturally, normally in our bodies, we have the enzyme reverse transcriptase. I did not know that. If I had known that, I would have been standing at the front of the line saying, this is going to get integrated. This vaccine is going to get integrated into our genomes because we make the enzyme that allows us to integrate mRNA into our DNA. And that's what's going to happen. And so for a long time, I was saying, no, you don't need to worry about the mRNA getting into your genome because you need the enzyme reverse transcriptase. And I thought that that was an enzyme that was in viruses and not in human beings, because that's what you hear. You know, and I went through a master's program, technically a PhD program. I just didn't get my PhD in biology, you know, and nobody ever said to me, by the way, human beings also have reverse transcriptase. And I was working in virology, so this seems like a gross oversight.
Yeah, like how was that overlooked? I mean, that seems like what you're saying. I mean, that's a huge component
I found it because I was looking for something else, doing research into evolution, not into vaccines or mRNA. I was looking at some explanations of evolutionary biology, and they were like, oh yeah, because humans have reverse transcript base, so you know, for millions of years or whatever, you know, they've been integrating viral DNA and genomes. And I had this moment of like, this vaccine is dangerous, we have to stop using it like now. And it was funny because it had nothing to do with the actual text that I was reading, but I was able to sort of put two and two together, because if we have reverse transcriptase, we're going to put that spike protein mRNA into our cells. Now, this has also been demonstrated in vitro. So in vitro just means in the test tube, basically. So it literally means in glass. We don't use glass much anymore. We mostly use plastics, but you know, they didn't want to change the name. So they took some human cells, and they put the vaccine, you know, particles in with them, and they discovered that those human cells in the petri dishes, they took up that mRNA and they integrated into their genomes. And so that's super bad news, because if that's happening in a petri dish, that's probably happening in human bodies. And if that's happening in human bodies, we don't know what the ultimate outcome of that is going to be. Now, it's a little bit less straightforward than I have spike protein mRNA, therefore that mRNA gets into my genome, therefore I'm going to produce spike proteins forever. It's not that simple, because it actually has to be integrated. For that to happen, it would have to be integrated behind a special region of DNA called a promoter that is going to cause it to be produced constitutively. And there are very few proteins that are just produced all the time in any given cell. So the likelihood of that DNA, that mRNA getting inserted in that right place is very low. But there's an extremely high likelihood of that mRNA getting inserted in a way that messes something else up, right?
Yeah.
And so yes. People have been wondering, you know, why do we seem to see this rise in cancer incidence?
These turbo cancers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people whose cancer was in remission for years coming right out of remission, people who, you know, it never had cancer before, you know, dying of cancer and right like that. You know, I know of at least one person that I know directly whose cancer came out of remission after being vaxxed and boosted and all that. And another person who developed novel brain cancer and is now passed away. And, you know, the first person whose cancer came out of remission is now on hospice. So both these men lost their lives, you know, to this cancer. And
I'm sure saying, well, they would never classify that or code it as being vaccine-related injury.
Right. Because how could the spike protein cause cancer? Well, it's not necessarily the spike protein that's causing cancer. It's probably that mRNA that's getting inserted into an area that's disrupting the very delicate balance between oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes. So an oncogene is a cancer promoting gene. If those things get turned on, it's like turning on the gas. And a tumor suppressor is a cancer preventing gene. Obviously, it sounds like what it is. It's like the brake. So if I turn on the gas and I take off the brake, so usually you have to have multiple mutations at a time. And of course, if you've got multiple strands of mRNA floating around inserting themselves all over your genome, then you could have multiple mutations at literally the same time in the same cell. You know, and then you have a cancer cell. And right, that is actually far more likely than somebody producing the spike protein forever, you know, now that they've been vaccinated. So this integration of the mRNA into the genome is a huge big problem. You know, I don't want to like change subjects too fast if you had some questions specifically about that one, but there's another big issue with RNA I want to address. So
yes, there are a couple of questions that I have. The first one is, so if the genome is then changing and you're turning on some things, you're turning off others. I'm just thinking about how many mothers were coerced into getting this while they were pregnant, mm-hmm. or so on and so forth. Could these genome changes then be handed down? My inclination is like, you've just changed her DNA irreparably, and that's going to be transmitted to her unborn children in the future. You're changing their DNA structure as well.
Right. So that's the thing, that it's going to take like decades for us to know exactly what the effects are going to be, because you can't actually predict that in advance. I mean, we don't even know, we can take a sequence that we think should make a protein the way that we think it should make and fold three-dimensionally the way that we think it should fold, that knowing all that we know about protein biochemistry, and we still have to test and make sure that protein folds correctly. And that's just like the very first step in going from mRNA to protein, let alone all the way up to an organism and the traits that they're going to have for the rest of their life and pass on to their offspring. So there's no way that we could predict, you know, what the long-term outcome of that is going to be in terms of passing things on to the next generation, how it's going to affect the next generation. Now, there's a few things that have come up already, you know, anecdotally or even been more established. And I would recommend for people who are really curious about this particular connection that you go to the High Wire, which is Del Bigtree's show.
I love the High
Wire. He's got some really good stuff covering this kind of injury. But, you know, just in my own personal experience, so I've traveled all over the country over the past few years. I've given presentations about creation. I've given presentations about vaccination. Given presentations about aborted fetal pharmaceuticals. There's a massive amount of people that I've talked to and met. And so one of these happened to be a nurse in Maryland. And so she was telling me how, you know, because she worked, I think she worked in the NICU is what she did, but she somehow was associated with premature babies in like neonatal care. So she told me that after they started convincing pregnant women to take the vaccine, they had a massive spike in stillbirths. And the other thing that they had, which is that's been really well documented. Again, that's covered really well on the High Wire.
Yeah.
Better than I could cover it here. So, but she also told me, and this is the thing that I thought was really interesting. And then I actually came home and saw it myself. So she said that a lot of these women, they will carry their baby to term, and the baby will be developing, and the baby should be crawling, and the baby's not crawling, and the baby should be walking, and the baby's not walking, and the baby's legs are like limp and noodly and weak, and there's something wrong with either the musculature or the nerves in the legs. Hmm. And I came home and I kind of filed that away, and I'm like, well, that's really weird. And I went and I visited a couple that I used to nanny for, and the unbeknownst to me, they had both taken the COVID vaccine. And they had a baby since I had last seen them. And I didn't know that they had a third child, and that was a delightful discovery. We'd kind of lost touch for a little while, but he's like slithering around the room, and he is old enough that he should be crawling, but he's like using his arms, like almost to army crawl, except he's not really crawling. He's just like his back end is just like swaying like a snake because he can't use his legs.
Mm.
And I literally saw it, you know, here's this mom who's vaccinated. The dad was vaccinated. Then, you know, I don't know if she was vaccinated while she was pregnant or vaccinated before he was conceived, but one of those two. And he's experiencing that same floppy leg syndrome that the nurse was telling me about in Maryland.
Wow.
You know, so I don't know how often this is happening, but I know of at least two babies in my circle of you know, acquaintances that have had trouble walking after the mom's been vaccinated. So, you know, that's affecting. So when the mom is vaccinated during pregnancy, that vaccine is affecting the baby far more directly than if the mom was vaccinated and then conceived.
I'm pulling up some messages I got from a nurse. Actually, she was my OB nurse, but I had my fourth during 2020 in the middle of August. Oh, wow. So everything was like locked down. Protocols were changing every other week. I feel like I almost don't even have enough time to find all of the messages. I was just looking at them the other day, mm-hmm. but she was describing the huge, like 200% increase in oncology cases, huge increase in stillbirths. I think she had experienced 16 stillbirths since this vaccine had rolled out, and she'd only experienced two in her over 10 years up to that point. And she said, I don't know what to do. And my OB's, my former OB's husband, because when I got pregnant again, I was like, I'm not delivering in a hospital still. Sure. I'm not doing that again. And one of the OBs that delivered the one that delivered Elijah, he had gotten the vaccine, and he's a young, healthy guy. Like actually, he was a doctor that was actually healthy. Which sometimes can be hard to find, but he was. And now he is going to be on blood thinners for the rest of his life because he had blood clots developed throughout his entire body. And his wife was my typical OB. They were OB-GYNs in the same hospital together, which was kind of interesting. And he helped at our pregnancy center. But She was the only doctor there that was advising her patients to wait until there was more information about these vaccines. The only one.
And
they felt like they were in a war zone. Like they didn't want to be there anymore. They felt like they had to try and warn people. It was so sad to talk to her about this situation. Yeah. I'll definitely share it on Twitter after this interview, but it was heartbreaking.
I believe it. Yeah. It's so hard. Sometimes to convince people of things that, you know, that they're not willing to believe, you know, and especially if they're scared, you know, so they get really scared about this COVID thing. And one of the things I wanted to bring up, even then, this is a great time to do it, is just, you know, the reason that we got here is because we just let ourselves be fed the five words: vaccines are safe and effective, period. Just unequivocally, from the time that we were being stuck in the arm in doctor's offices when we were little, to the time that we're growing up and having our own kids, to the time that, you know, we're becoming grandparents. Like, there's whole generations of people who've just been fed this since the polio vaccine came out, that vaccines are like the way to deal with viruses. Like, because you can't, there's no antibiotic for viruses. You know, there's antivirals, but they don't really do the same thing. They don't knock the virus out in the same way. You know, and so viruses are these big scary things that we can't deal with, you know, because we're ignoring our God-given immune system.
Physiology,
which are actually designed to deal with viruses. But you know, and they're not infallible, but that's because we're mortal. Like, you can't reduce the risk of death to zero, ever.
No.
You can't even reduce it from 100%. You can't reduce it to 98%. Like, you cannot reduce the risk of your eventual death at all. You will die. And whether it's a virus or getting hit by a bus, you know, that's all in God's hands anyway. So, like, I think that we've been living in this very materialistic society, especially since World War II. We had the advent of this polio vaccine that seemed to save millions. And I have tons of things I could say about the polio vaccine and how, like, actually not terribly important it was, which will be very politically incorrect. You know, the situation with polio is so much more complicated because we were stuck in this like way of thinking that we know now is wrong, you know, and we could have known at the time if we hadn't been quite so stuck on it. But scientists do this. They get the newest, biggest thing, and that's what we're doing. And we were very stuck because of Koch's postulates on this idea that one germ, one disease, right? And one disease, one germ. So poliomyelitis, which is the disease that where you get paralyzed, is actually caused by like 12 or 14 different things, one of which is the polio virus. You know, so we were chasing a vaccine for a virus that wasn't even causing the majority of cases, probably, of paralytic polio, you know, and we instituted the vaccine and, you know, you saw this dramatic drop in cases, but nobody tells you when you look at the graph that, oh, by the way, they actually redefined polio so that, you know, before the vaccine was introduced, if you were paralyzed at all, you were given a diagnosis of polio. And after the vaccine was introduced, you had to be paralyzed for 60 days if they were going to diagnose you with polio. And most paralytic polio resolved before 60 days was up. Like, the iron lung thing was very, very, very rare, you know, and that's not the image that we're presented. We're presented with this whole, sorry, I'm going on and on. About
no,
polio,
because, but. No, but I think this is really important because they did redefine COVID cases. COVID,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah,
can you
when Biden was elected.
That. Yes, that's exactly when it happened.
And it was a little, it was a less dramatic redefinition. But it went from, if you had symptoms or you had a positive test, you got a diagnosis of COVID. Or in some cases, even if you didn't have symptoms specific to COVID and you didn't have a test, they diagnosed you with COVID. I had a friend who almost died from a bacterial infection, who they told had COVID. So it's in her medical records that she was diagnosed with COVID. They didn't test her. She didn't have the proper symptoms. She was actually suffering from a foodborne illness, which she would have died if a friend of mine who was in culinary school hadn't said, I think you have this bacteria, go back and ask them to check. Like, she's on the record as the COVID case. Like, how many statistics are like that? You know?
Else existed, right? Like, the numbers for flu just went away. Like, they disappeared. Right. Like, the flu did not exist
the flu
at all. Yeah.
You know, so, but then of course, after the vaccine rolled out and also after Biden was elected to do all the, or whatever, anyway, maybe not elected,
I love this. This is a great interview.
And here I said I was going to try not to get you flagged.
Yeah, but you did say that.
And then I opened my big mouth. But so anyway, after the elections, they redefined COVID to be you had to have a positive test and symptoms, and then we'll write you down as COVID. So in that case, my friend wouldn't have been given a diagnosis of COVID, right? And how many other people wouldn't have been given a diagnosis of COVID? So you see on the graph, this like, we're going up, we're going up, we're going down, we're going up, we're going, oh, look, we went way down right after the vaccine. Well, that's because we redefined the case definition. I mean, we've lived through this. Mm-hmm. We just lived through this like a few years ago. So it's not that shocking that they've been doing it from the beginning. They did it with the measles vaccine. They did it with polio vaccine. I'm sure it's done with other vaccines, but those are the ones that I'm most familiar with, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was a very, very long tangential digression about polio, but I'm working on a new chapter for the updated version of my vaccine book, which will eventually come out if I don't, you know, spend the rest of 2024 trying not to die like I did in 2023. it's okay. I mean, I'm here. So obviously God has a purpose for me and maybe I'll finish the book, but eventually, God willing, I will come out with an updated version of the vaccine book that will have a whole chapter on polio. And in the meantime, if you're super curious by all the stuff I've just said, you can go read The Moth and the Iron Lung by Forrest Merriti. But keep in mind that Forrest Merriti, shortly after he wrote that book, I think within 2 years, like sort of fell off the weirdo wagon and started his own like weird semi-Protestant religion, which isn't really a religion. It's very strange. So Forrest Merriti is a weird guy. Don't necessarily take everything he says seriously, but he's a journalist as well where he documents the development of polio, things that he's talking about that actually sound like they could be factual or generally factual. The things that he talks about that sound pretty fantastic are just that. They're fantastic. So just keep that in mind when you read the book, but very good book. And then of course they cover it in Dissolving Illusions as well. There's a bit on polio and I wasn't quite ready to believe it when I read Dissolving Illusions. And then I've read more and more and more and more on both sides, you know, the people who are like, it wasn't as big of a deal. And the people who are like, it was going to kill everybody, you know? So it's just it's a big mess. I feel like I missed answering a question that you asked.
You were going to talk a little bit more about, the mRNA, I believe, specifically.
Yes, yes. So, you know, curiously, it's funny to look back on all of this because for many years I thought that my life was basically a string of failures. So I failed to work in the pharmaceutical industry. Thanks be to God. I failed to get my PhD. You know, I there were a couple other failures along there that were personal. But I didn't realize that our Lord was actually equipping me with a bunch of weird random bits of things that I was going to be able to synthesize together in direct relation to the COVID situation. So one of the random things that I picked up along the way, when I first went to undergrad in 2000, there was a subsidiary of Monsanto called the Danforth Center that I wanted to work for. And yes, I've repented of that. So nobody needs to comment. But they were working on developing edible vaccines. So I thought this was a great idea because, of course, you know, when I was 18 years old, I totally believed those five words. Vaccines are safe and effective. Like, they're the way to deal with disease. They're totally the way to deal with disease in the third world. I had no idea about all of the crazy stuff that we've been pushing on the third world in terms of population control vaccines. Like that in Kenya, I actually corresponded with one of the doctors who was involved in discovering that they were covertly sterilizing people using a tetanus vaccine in Kenya. This mm-hmm. is maybe about 10 years ago. And
this has happened several times in history, even in America. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's something that people also don't understand is that the government has had full blown vaccine programs with the intention primarily to sterilize certain populations. And those are programs being enacted around the world and have been historically enacted here in the United States as well.
Sure. Sure. I'm not actually familiar with them being enacted here. Do you know which ones they were?
No, and I'm thinking
we've done a lot of like really, really terrible stuff, like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment and stuff like that. I mean, we could go on and on.
Well, they have sterilized, especially minority communities, yep. and that's very well documented, tying tubes and things like that. Maybe I shouldn't have spoken so assertively on that. But I feel like I have heard stuff about this being used.
Well, if you come across the specific, definitely email me because I want to.
Yes, I will.
I know about instances in the Philippines, in Kenya, in other areas of Africa. India. Because again, it is usually the minorities, because, you know,
or disabled. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, the American eugenics program, people don't realize the American eugenics program was where the Nazis got their ideas, you know, because it started in America and the UK actually, in terms of like, you know, we're gonna achieve better human beings through keeping the lesser ones from breeding, you know, or mm-hmm. like rabbits or something, which is just sick.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think I lost a question or something in there.
RNA.
The mRNA vaccines. So, okay, right. So we were talking about vaccines in the third world. So the Danforth Center was going to create, that was their goal was to create edible vaccines, which I thought was a great idea because I hate needles. And also because you could actually grow them in the third world countries that are suffering from so much disease, which really actually just, they just need help with like sanitation and infrastructure, not vaccines. Right. But and that's actually been proven like multiple times that would make more of a difference than the vaccines. But at the time I thought, well, if you could grow a banana tree in Africa, you know, and then just eat a banana and now you're vaccinated for typhoid or something like that, you know, that would be amazing. But it turns out that in order to make an edible vaccine, they have to genetically engineer the banana, right? So they're taking that, this might sound familiar, right? They're taking the genetic information to make a vaccine antigen, like the spike protein, and they're putting it in that banana. And now bananas are polyploid, so they get kind of messy. But basically, they discovered with whatever plant they were trying to use that they could not control how many copies of the antigen genetic information, the mRNA, that the plant took up. And they could not control how many copies of the vaccine antigen it made from the mRNA. So
you couldn't control dosage
you absolutely cannot control dosage because there's two points along the pipeline of this process where you can't control dosage. So if you took 1,000 different people and you gave them all the exact same amount of mRNA, which we actually know doesn't happen anyway, because the quality control on this stuff is so terrible that you've got some vials that have nothing in them and some vials that have way too much mRNA in them and some vials that just have empty little
nanoparticles.
Thank you.
Yes.
Anemone.
We'll get it out.
So even if you were perfectly like to within the nanogram of exactly the same amount of mRNA at every single vaccine dose, you can't control how much of that mRNA is going to get taken up into the person's cells. And once that person takes up those cells, you can't control how much antigen that person is going to make. And then the third layer that you get with a human being is you can't control how their immune system is going to respond to that dosage of antigen, mm-hmm. right? Because everybody, we have different immune systems. So my immune system is like shot all to pieces because of my recurrent chronic illnesses, right? But somebody with a really healthy immune system, like a young man who, you know, is an athlete, right? He's going to have a really robust immune system. And it turns out that I'm actually going to suffer less from the mRNA vaccine than he is, you know,
really?
And that's what we're seeing. Yep.
Oh,
we're seeing young people. We're seeing young people have really bad reactions to this because their immune systems are more robust. Right. And their ability to take up the DNA and produce the proteins is more robust. So they're getting a higher dosage. Right. And then the other problem that you're seeing, especially with athletes, is because the spike protein, we know now, I don't know. Because I was spending a lot of time looking at literature. I wasn't necessarily looking for this, but I don't know that there was really any coherent signal in the literature that the spike protein was going to be cause cardiac damage until after it started happening. We started seeing the cardiac damage. Now then it became a very clear signal, but it got ignored anyway, as we were talking about before we came on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to say that, you know, oh, they knew it was going to cause all this heart damage or all this cardiac damage and they picked it on purpose. Well, no, they picked it because it's one of the two proteins they could pick on the outside of the virus. And the N protein is historically an even worse candidate for vaccines than the spike protein because, you know, because I did look through a lot of research on trying to make vaccines for SARS and MERS, you know, because those were the only coronavirus vaccines we were really looking at making prior to COVID. So So we found out later that spike protein was damaging to your circulatory system. It's damaging to your heart. It's causing the blood clots, all, you know, all that, all that. Everybody knows that at this point, you know, it's pretty incontrovertible. But you take a young man who's, or a young woman who's an athlete, you know, but young men, it seems to affect even more. And you inject them and they go out and run a workout that afternoon. And they run a workout the next afternoon, and they run a workout the next afternoon because they're not sick with the spike protein. They've been injected with the spike protein. So if when I had COVID, I was laying on the couch, unable to get, I couldn't have run. I mean, I can't run anyway because of my ankle, but like I couldn't possibly have run a, any kind of physical workout when I was sick. And even
a
friend of mine who was like a professional athlete, when he was sick with COVID, also couldn't get off the couch and run around. So while he had that damaging spike protein in his system, he's not pumping his blood, you know, through his heart at an excessive rate.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's very slow because he's sick and he's laying on the couch and he's not moving. And like, you know, it's about how the cells
are interacting in the system. Right. We talked about this a little bit in our last interview. When you're injecting somebody into the circulatory and blood system, that's going to have a different impact on the body than someone who is naturally receiving a virus and the normal mechanisms through which your body is going to process and deal with that virus. Those are very different things.
Right. Because if you're getting the virus through inhalation, right. Then the virus is going to be congregating in a certain part of your body, not necessarily going directly in your bloodstream. So you've got that problem going on too. But then these guys are dropping dead on the field after being vaccinated because they have all that spike protein and they're doing extremely athletic work and it's actually causing heart damage. And the problem with heart damage. So there's a lot, I think there's a lot of mythology in modern medicine about what is and is not incurable. You know, for example, I know people generally think that things like depression are incurable. And I would argue with the best of them that that is absolutely not true. You know,
my own experience would dictate that that's untrue. I mean,
yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, and no way,
you know, things like cancer are incurable. Again, I would argue that that's not true. But things like heart damage, your heart does not produce new cells in the same way that your skin does, in the same way that your liver does, you know, and even nerves don't produce new cells nearly as often as, you know, so if you get a, you know, severed spinal cord, you're going to have a really hard time recovering from that. But peripheral nerves do recover. And I my own experience has been that you can reverse peripheral nerve damage. You know, so there's a lot of things that are reversible, but heart damage is not one of those. Heart damage is not reversible because you're so dependent on your heart for everything else that's going on. I mean, if your heart stops, that's kind of it. You know, we talk about brain death.
It doesn't have time to heal because it's not getting a break. In other words, like it's not getting.
And it just doesn't. So your heart gets built and it works, but you don't really get like an influx of new cells. You know, you're not, there's nothing really abrasive rubbing on your heart. It's in that pericardium to keep it nice and insulated. So it's not like your skin where you're rubbing cells off anytime you brush against anything, you know, or your intestines where you're rubbing cells off as you're digesting things. You know, it's very protected. It just doesn't regenerate. Like, you know, human beings don't regenerate a lot of things. We can regenerate our liver. We can regenerate some skin. You know, we can regenerate some peripheral nerves, but we can't regenerate our heart.
Well, this is something too. I mean, I read today and it's almost infuriating because there have been a lot of people kind of sounding the alarm for a few years now about this link between an increase in heart, brain, blood disorders. You know, all of these kinds of issues. I'm actually going to put it up on the screen if I can. Sure. Yeah, I want to show this because finally we're getting some attention drawn from the likes of the New York Post. And I was surprised because, I mean, for a long time now, if you posted anything about this on social media, your posts wouldn't get any views or you would be outright like kicked off of platforms.
You're spreading misinformation.
Exactly. You get like a little warning box. And so rare case, I love that they downplay it. Rare cases of myocarditis, inflammation of the heart muscle were found first. And it does highlight the mRNA vaccine specifically. But the thing is I don't think it's nearly as rare as they're wanting to let on. I sort of feel like this happens when you're talking about more propaganda or just how things are handled. Like, it's a slow drip, right? And you get people acclimated or comfortable with the idea that this actually might be happening before the whole lid gets blown off of something. What are your thoughts about that? And even perhaps, do you have any thoughts about what embalmers have said about, Jeremiah is wondering like what your thoughts are about embalmers who have said that they're seeing so many more blood clots in people that they're embalming and things, fibrous things that like they've never seen before. Oh no, I can't hear you. I lost your audio. Sorry about that. Yeah. Or maybe it's just me. Can you guys hear Pamela still? Because I can't, but I was having audio issues before we came on.
Hear me again?
Yes, I can hear you.
Mm-hmm. I fat fingered my microphone.
That's okay. Okay.
No, I just was saying.
Uh-oh. I can't hear you again. Yeah, one second. Okay. Yeah, I'll make sure that we bring up some of these other questions because a lot of you guys have really great questions. I see one talking about flu shots.
Okay. No.
Oh, yeah. There we go.
I think the battery on this is just dead. That's why, because it turned right back off. So I switched to the other microphone. So probably the quality is less good, but you know, whatever.
That's okay.
You can at least hear me. So I don't personally know any embalmers or any people that I could verify that with. And I'm not a physiologist. It's funny. People are like, oh, you're a biologist. I got some weird pain in my side. What do you think that is? And I'm like, if it's bigger than a cell, I can't help you. So I can help you with the mRNA. That's smaller than a cell, but
yes.
I don't know enough to know, one way or the other, how to pass judgment on that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I know that a lot of the microscope images that you were seeing were faked. Like, so
okay.
There was a lot of, so people kept sending me microscope images like there's parasites in the vaccine and there's
yes,
this in the vaccine and
the luciferase. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Again, well, the luciferase, see that one just like, it gets me every time. Like we have used luciferase in the lab for like a billion years. Okay. We haven't been doing lab work for a billion years, but basically since we started doing lab work, it's a reporter gene. It's because it's the gene in the fireflies that makes them light up. Like that's what it is.
Okay.
Like it's not this creepy, weird, like satanic thing. Like it's,
yes. Yeah.
Yeah, it was named luciferase because
it lights up.
People, yes, exactly. Insect people tend to be very creative, and they named it because that's what makes.
But that's the Latin,
right?
I mean,
what was that?
Isn't that the Latin for light?
Yeah, this light bearer. You know, yeah, so it light, was actually the name, the original name of the devil before he fell.
Exactly, you know, Lucifer. So. Yes.
Yeah. So people, people in biology are not very reverent, and they thought it was funny. It wasn't because it was some creepy weird thing.
So some of those were, I mean, and I expected that too. I mean, that some of these things are fake photos. And mm-hmm. That's the thing that's so hard about all of this too, is that there was a lot of hysteria. Like,
yeah.
I mean, on both sides. And I understand that you get into something that is unprecedented in terms of
it's big and it's scary and people you want people to take you seriously, and then you see something and you know, so how many of you in the audience have ever, you know, spent hours looking through a microscope? Probably none of you. You know, right. I've spent hours looking through a microscope because I'm a science teacher and I think it's cool and I own my microscope. But like, you know, so I'm familiar with, if I look through something in a light field microscope, kind of what it should look like. But if somebody shows you an image that they're saying is this kind of microscopy, but I know that you can't get an image that way, you know, that you're not going to know that, you know, you're just going to look at it and be like, oh no, there's all this terrible stuff going on. So again, I'm going to kick you over to the high wire. They did a really good episode. I think the doctor's name was Ryan Cole. I'm pretty sure it was Cole, but he looked at a bunch of this stuff under the microscope and debunked a lot of the stuff that's not legitimate. And he just did a really, really, really good job. Again, better than I could do here in a few minutes. Because I'm just going to rant about, you know, how easy it is to misinterpret dark field microscopy and how people are looking. But in the case of the little things that look like little amoebas, that was dust.
That was dust.
Because they weren't preparing their microscopes in a fume, or not a fume hood, a laminar flow hood. So like when you're in a laminar flow hood, the air is moving in such a way that nothing is going to settle on your microscope. If I'm just preparing a microscope slide right here and I go to look at it really closely, I'm going to find all kinds of weird bits of stuff that's falling out of my air on it. You know, so yeah,
That's really interesting. Yeah. And there are some other good questions here too. Like Family Room TV, what is the rate of myocarditis though? I've heard that it's about 1 in 6,000. And I think too, we're not talking about myocarditis in just a general population. We're talking about athletes and young people specifically,
yes, pericarditis. A really bad spike in the younger people. And I don't know the numbers. And the reason I don't know the numbers is because the numbers are so difficult to determine. Like the people who are tracking the statistics don't want us to be able to make the very simple distinctions of like, what was the rate of myocarditis before COVID and what's the rate of myocarditis now? And that's historical too, because there's a great gal, her name's Dr. Teresa Deischer over at Soundtrack Pharmaceuticals. Amazing. You know, she was tracking a dose dependent increase in autism every time we introduced a new aborted fetal vaccine. So she was fulfilling one of the Bradford Hill criteria for causality between aborted fetal vaccines and induction of autism. And then the CDC scrambled the way that they tracked those statistics, so she couldn't track it by year anymore.
Well, and I think that's another really good point, because here again, Family Room TV is saying, how do we know that the increase in blood clots isn't due to prior COVID infection? Are we just assuming it's due to vaccination? You know, and a lot of these statistics in a sense are hard to find, because VAERS is notoriously underreported. A lot of these things are underreported.
Like you can't, one of the great points that I was reading a book called Turtles All the Way Down, which is a really good book.
I just saw something about that book.
It's great. Just read it. It's super accessible too. They're saying things that I didn't know, you know, and that's saying something. So, but the way that you would know that is you would have to have a very, very, very careful case study of an individual, you know, from the time that the COVID showed up until the time that they're developing myocarditis, and track when they're being vaccinated and exactly what's going on in their body and their blood, and, you know, all of this sort of thing. And nobody's doing that research, you know, nobody's doing that research. So I think that there is some incidence of cardiovascular damage that's actually caused by COVID. I think that we underreacted to COVID because you had the split, right? You had the people who were like, it's going to kill you. And the people like, oh, it's just a cold. It's not just a cold. It is.
Yeah, that was not my experience. I almost died personally.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that
I know people who got extremely, extremely sick, who don't normally get sick. And the other thing that we're seeing now is that illnesses are just affecting people a lot more, just in general, like regular illnesses.
Do you think it's because of our gut flora and just things like our immune systems are just not intact?
So there's a couple things going on, right? You can actually have subclinical cardiovascular damage from COVID that you don't know about, right? And that's mm-hmm. going to affect your response to any time you're sick, right? You could have immune exhaustion. You know, your immune system is just depleted from getting COVID, and then you get another illness too soon, and then it's still depleted, and you get another illness after that too soon.
Oh yeah, I was sick for months. Like I almost died, and I was pregnant. I was like 20 weeks pregnant, I think, when I finally started to get over COVID. Mm-hmm. But then I was sick for almost the rest of my pregnancy with one flu or cold after another. Mm-hmm. It didn't stop. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, then the other thing you can have is you can have recombination of COVID viral information with other normal natural viruses. Because if you're co-infected with two things, those things can genetically recombine under certain circumstances. Hmm. So we might have all kinds of freaking viruses that we're not aware of because nobody's sequencing them right now. Because we wouldn't have been aware of COVID if no one had sequenced it. But the other thing that we have to understand in all of this is that we are not dealing with a natural virus. And that's actually been evident. That's been super clear from the beginning. I read the very first paper that was supposed to debunk it and say it was totally natural. And I'm looking at his citations, and he's basically walking me through in the citations exactly how you would manufacture a genetically engineered coronavirus. So it's been done. It's published in the literature. We know how to do these things. There's signatures in the spike protein that shouldn't be there if it's a natural protein. Like, we're dealing with a man-made virus, mm-hmm. and that changes everything, because our bodies are not designed to deal with that virus. The natural flora and fauna, you know, just in the environment around us and our own bodies, not designed to deal with that virus. So this is now unleashed on the world. And so we don't actually know, you know, how negatively that's impacting us when we get sick. We do know, just like we were talking about, you know, that you are far more likely to incur damage when you're healthy and you're vaccinated, because that spike protein is going to be circulating in your body at top speed when you're doing something, you know, you're running around for soccer or you're doing a bunch of exercising or things like that. That's going to cause the damage to increase. We know that that is how that works. So it's not unreasonable to think that these healthy people who are getting the spike protein are going to have more cardiovascular, or getting the spike protein through the vaccine, are going to have more cardiovascular damage than people who are getting the spike protein through the illness. Because again, it's going to be localized in a different way. It's going to be pumping through your body in a different way. It's going to probably be a lower dosage, honestly, because of the way the mRNA vaccines work. But in some people, it's going to be a higher dosage. But we don't know that, you know. So there's a lot of things that we don't know. And no, we're not just assuming that the damage is due to the vaccine, because there's a lot of cases where, you know, we are seeing much worse damage in people who are vaccinated than we're seeing in people who did not get vaccinated, you know. And it's just kind of naive to think that somehow the virus itself is, that's being, even though it's a you know, a lab engineered virus, it's still based on a natural viral particle that still has to replicate in that normal natural way. It is kind of naive to think that process is going to somehow be more damaging than taking the most damaging part of that virus and then artificially causing our body to produce who knows how much of it, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a former virologist, as a former vaccine developer, you know, I don't think we're making, you know, baseless assumptions at all. I think they're very reasonable. And unfortunately, again, based on the data, you know, we're having to make extrapolations because we don't have the actual data that we really need to make all the proper distinctions, you know. But I do think that they're both damaging, but I definitely should say the vaccine is more damaging.
Yeah. And that's exactly where I land on this, only because, like you, my experience, I mean, I have a couple, at least two autoimmune diseases, probably more. Mm-hmm.
They like to travel in groups.
They do. But I didn't know that for a long time. So I always thought everything I had was from this one autoimmune disease. And I was like, well, why do I still feel like crap? Why do I just feel like garbage all the time? And then all of a sudden it dawned on me, well, there are probably cofactors going on there, probably infection or like co-diseases going on. But anyway, Claire, to answer your question about vax shedding, we do address that actually in part one. So go back and listen to that interview. And
the answer is yes, but not for the COVID vaccine.
Yeah. So yes, for the COVID.
That's a simple answer.
Yes, there's a simple answer right now. Let's see. This is another good question. Then I want to talk to you about the data, because I think this is actually really an important question for asking about the data and effectiveness. So Family Room TV wants to know, would you agree that the vaccine is safer than the virus for elderly people?
Absolutely not.
Because why? Because what you're saying, if I'm listening to you, I would say, okay, but you're saying if you have a weaker immune system, you're going to mount less of a response probably. So why not?
Because with elderly people, you run into higher risks of activating cancer. That's why. So the elderly people are, yes, if you vaccinate them for COVID, they might be less likely to die from COVID, but they're not going to be less likely to die in the next few years.
Yeah.
Since an elderly person has accumulated so many more mutations over their lifetime, you know, they might already have mutations in various parts of their body in either tumor suppressors or oncogenes. And all they need is one mutation then to get the cancer ball rolling. A lot of elderly people have had some kind of cancer that they're either fighting or is in remission. You know, so if the elderly person has a risk of cancer, has had cancer, or even is just like particularly elderly, like, you know, the one person that I'm thinking of whose cancer came out of remission was in his 80s, extremely, extremely healthy otherwise, you know, totally like could have lived to be 120 kind of guy, you know, and is currently, you know, on hospice. So,
well, and that's a really interesting point, because I have a sister at the time, she was working in like hospice care. She as a nurse, and she had, I think she was doing mostly at home care. So she was visiting people, doing nursing care for them. And she said there were clients of hers or patients of hers, I should say, that all of a sudden their memory was like horrible. Their behaviors were, they had totally changed and declined rapidly.
The mRNA and the lipid nanoparticles can cross the blood-brain barrier, and that's why in some individuals you do see that cognitive decline or some sort of neurological damage. And the other thing that's really important to remember with elderly people too is because you have to boost and boost and boost and boost, and we know that like constant boosting with the same antigen causes immune exhaustion, that means that anything else that they get exposed to in their environment is going to be harder for them to fight off. And they already are going to have a harder time fighting off regular infections. So again, I don't think it's worth the risk even for somebody who's elderly, but for different reasons than for somebody who's young.
So looking at the research then, because there are so many unknowns still. I mean, we're not going to really know the implications of all of this on our health for decades to come. Mm-hmm. And that's if we're doing the follow-up research. So What about the research beforehand where we rushed this out to the market as fast as possible? I listened to Highwire too, and I want you to explain this. I know a lot of this information, but I probably could not articulate it nearly as well as you can. But what about these phases of clinical trials? Were they happening? Were they not happening? What were happening to patients that maybe were having adverse reactions and their data? What happened?
There's so much that could be said here. I mean, there were hundreds, actually probably between 100 and 200. So dozens, revise that correctly. So I'm not exaggerating. Dozens of COVID vaccines in production that were going from preclinical trials to phase one, to phase two, to phase three. I was tracking it on Gavi for a while, and then I kind of fell off the radar, but you know, the average vaccine takes 10 years to develop. You know, from initial concept to actually injecting it into people. And most vaccines never pass the preclinical trials. You know, so most vaccines that we're trying to develop don't pass preclinical, or they get to clinical phase one and they get scrapped, or they get to clinical phase two and they get scrapped. Of the, we'll just give a ballpark of 150, right? Because it's somewhere between 100 and 200, I think it's closer to 200. About 150 vaccines that were in development for COVID, only like 8 of them got scrapped. And usually I think between like 70 and 90% of vaccines would get scrapped.
That's interesting.
As they're going from development to injecting them. So there is something about this process where people were willing to overlook, problems, because every mRNA vaccine that had been developed to that point, including the one that I was working on in the laboratory, which was both a viral vector and a DNA vaccine at the same time, have not made it to being in a phase three clinical trial, let alone to being injected into people. And it's because of various safety concerns that show up in, you know, when you get into the phase one or phase two clinical trials. So one of the ways that with the COVID vaccine in particular, and I've looked most closely at the Pfizer data, so I'm going to pick on Pfizer. I also used to work for Pfizer, you know, it's just full circle, as an intern at one point. The Pfizer data, they did a couple of things that were pretty shady. They did, to their credit, use an actual placebo, which was saline. So most vaccine manufacturers, when they test a vaccine, they don't use an actual placebo. They will either use the vaccine, all the ingredients in the vaccine sans the antigen. So basically it's like the whole thing, except just not the spike protein. If we were talking about a traditional vaccine for COVID, or they will use a previous generation of the vaccine. So now you would get people saying, oh, well, we're going to test this new COVID vaccine against the Pfizer COVID vaccine. And look, the adverse events are the same in the placebo group and the trial group. So, you know, we know it's safe, and that's just not actually accurate. And again, Charles all the way down is going to deal with that particular aspect of vaccine manufacturing way better than I could. But in the Pfizer trial in particular, they did not test everyone for COVID who reported symptoms of COVID. Now that by itself, so think about that, let me say it again. They did not test everyone for COVID who reported symptoms of COVID. It was up to the doctor to decide whether they were going to actually test the person or not, and whether they were actually going to report it as a case of COVID or not. So that right there destroys their whole research methodology. They should have tested every single individual who presented with any kind of COVID symptom for COVID. And now we know the tests are garbage, but at least they should have been, you know, applying their own rules, you know, to the situation. Or they should have reported every single person who had symptoms of COVID as suspected COVID. but they didn't do that.
So then there's no information then about the efficacy of it. I mean, because you can't determine that if you're not collecting all the data.
Right.
That's really interesting. So, and this is an aside, Family Room TV is back and he's wondering, or he or she, I'm not finding any information about a link between the vaccine and cancer risk. Which studies was she referring to? I'm not sure that she was referring necessarily to a study, although there might be some out there, but she's talking about the mechanisms of how mRNA works specifically in the body.
And also just what I've seen, you know, in
and I've been told too by medical professionals
that have been vaccinated. So that I can definitely get back to you. And if you have a way to post to people like Twitter or whatever you're talking about, I will send you some links on cancer risk.
That'd be great.
I'm pretty sure I printed out some studies on that the other day.
Yeah, I would love that. I would love to share that.
Yeah. So, and, you know, I think there's so many different things I could say about peer reviewed studies. And that could lead to a whole other digression, like the digression on polio, but, there are studies that are not allowed to be done. And there are studies that are done that are not allowed to be published.
Yep.
And so when you're thinking about doing science, you actually have to do science, which means that you actually have to pay attention to the data that's in front of you. And you actually have to pay attention to the experiences that you're having and the real world things that are playing out in your own experience, in your own life. And then you judge the studies by that radar. The problem that we have right now with this whole, we have a, and I'm going to have a talk on this in October out in the East Coast somewhere. I forget where. I'm going to give a talk on scientism. Like, we have this idea that, like, unless it's published in Nature, it's not true. Well, I literally just watched it happen. Therefore, you know, therefore I have some data, and I have some data that I'm looking at that is actually way more important than data that's being filtered through the lens of, you know, the publishers at Nature. And if you look at the number of advertisements that are in the average scientific journal, you're going to get a feel for how, you know, who gets to decide what research is published. So this has been a problem. This is a problem with evolutionary biology. It's been a problem for decades. Yeah. This is a problem with studies on aluminum and human safety. This is a problem with studies in anything related to vaccines.
Yeah, I was going to say the logical Catholic is here saying, so it's just based on anecdotal evidence. No, I think that misses the point. Although anecdotal evidence can be useful evidence. And I think just to put a finer point on what Pamela is saying, you have to pay attention to who's funding the research. Number one, how this research is being carried out, whether it is following a double-blind randomized study, how big the study is, all of these other things. But when you start paying attention to who is funding this research, like, for example, I remember when I worked for LifeSite News several years ago, and at the time we published this really interesting article about, I think it was four researchers or four people who posed as researchers, and they were able to get totally bunk, quote unquote, research published in major research journals, major journals, because it aligned with their agenda. Like that's all it was. The research didn't happen. It didn't exist. There was no way of like replicating this study. It was all garbage. And it highlighted the point was that a lot of these places are captured. So that's why we can't always look at everything and say, well, the experts got us into a really big mess. The quote unquote experts, it's okay to look at the world around you and use some common sense and say, this doesn't comport with my experience. And that's okay. That doesn't make you like a bad person. That doesn't make you a stupid person. It's part of just thinking critically. We need to think critically and not always defer to the quote unquote expertise of other people who are being bought and paid for a lot of the time.
I am like 97% sure I have papers that I have printed out on cancer and COVID-19. I just can't rattle the citations off to you. Because that wasn't what I was researching this morning. So my short-term recall is not very good, you know, but the point that I was just trying to make is very much what Angela said, you know, that this idea that like, in a certain sense, it's not about the studies because there's so many different ways to manipulate a study. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. Dr. Ben Goldacre has written two entire books on the subject called Bad Science and Bad Pharma. about all the different ways to manipulate the studies. It's documented in Turtles all the way down, all the different ways to manipulate the studies. You know, so even if I looked at a study, and it said there's a link between COVID vaccine and cancer, I would be like, I don't know about that. Let me read your methods. You know, just because a study is claiming something doesn't necessarily, unfortunately, mean that it's true. And just because there isn't a study on something doesn't necessarily mean it's not a link.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Because you have to account for so many factors and things like that.
Right.
And two, I think just data and statistics in general, they mean nothing without context. And so are you creating the proper context?
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not enough to compare. And this is something else that people kind of miss about clinical studies. Even people who are doing clinical studies, you can't actually just compare rates of an experimental group to quote unquote baseline rates, because your experimental group is going to have a different composition than the general population. So if your experimental group is like all healthy adults between the ages of 20 and 40, that's very different than the average population. So you can't take data from that group and compare it to a baseline. You actually have to do a controlled study where you're looking at people who didn't get the vaccine, who were age matched and gender matched and socioeconomically matched and from the same part of the country, because, you know, you have to control for factors like drinking water and, you know, radiation, local radiation, and, you know, all that sort of thing, you know, and those studies aren't being done in that way. So that's the part that's just kind of really frustrating. So,
well, and the logical Catholic brings up a good point too, because they're saying, well, the logical conclusion of what you're saying is that we can't trust anything. And in a way, yeah, like, I don't know, you don't think so? I just like black pilled on this stuff, because there's always people wanting something from you.
I'm in a very different position than your average person, because I have a background in all of this stuff.
Yeah.
So I can read a scientific paper and I can have a pretty good idea, you know, professionally, whether what's being reported is good or what's being reported is bunk. And there is some stuff that's being reported that's good. What I'm saying, what I'm trying to get across, apparently very incoherently and unclearly, is that if what we're reading does not match our experience of reality, we should be distrusting it. So when you're looking at scientific papers, when you're looking at things that are being presented by the experts, when you're looking at things that are being presented on the news, when you're looking at things that are being told to you by your coworker, right? So this is, you know, this is why I maintain the position that COVID vaccines do not shed, because I've looked at the evidence. I've looked at the reports. I've looked at, you know, a lot of it is anecdotal, right? Okay. You know, and again, I'm looking at my own environment. I'm looking at what's happening in my own environment. I'm looking at the fact that I live next door to somebody who's been vaxxed and vaxxed and vaxxed and revaxxed, and I've never had anything occur that remotely matches the shedding phenomenon. You know, I'm looking at that normal things that I'm seeing in my environment. I'm applying the information that I have as a virologist, as a geneticist, you know, the people, the things that I know about the way that the mRNA molecule works, about equilibrium kinetics, you know, all that sort of thing. And I'm looking at the phenomenon and I'm saying, this does not match with what I understand about reality. Right. And we actually have to engage and we have to think that way. And that was the point really that I was trying to make. And I was probably trying to make it through the back door, you know, but it seemed like a good opportunity to make it, given that, you know, I didn't happen to have the citation for the cancer study right off the tip of my tongue. So, you know, it's just, and I do just get really frustrated, you know, when people are like, well, I have this study that says this. Well, I have this study that says that. Well, I have a study that says that peer-reviewed studies are bogus. So, like, you know, it's not that you can't believe anything. It's that you have to actually very carefully look at and evaluate the research that's being presented to you, right? And so that's where a soundbite is not enough, you know, and a podcast is not enough. And, you know, I would need to write you an academic research paper to answer the questions that you're asking in the way that you want me to answer them, you know, and that's the part where, you know, yeah, I want people to understand that just because somebody puts on a white coat and stands at a lab bench with a pipette doesn't mean that everything they do is totally and completely, you know, above board, because it's just not. You're muted.
Sorry, I heard the kids like rattling the door, so I knew that a kid was going to come in, and you guys probably saw Veronica come up into my lap. But it makes me think of the Milgram experiments, right? Am I remembering that correctly, where people just automatically assume that someone in a lab coat has authority over them and can coerce them into doing things that they would never do? And I feel like people forgot about that. Like, they forgot about this experiment. And to me, my mind goes back to it all the time, especially when we're talking about this.
Well, and it tells you something about human nature, too, that I think is really important. You know, like if 65% of people in the Milgram experience were willing to do, obviously they didn't do it because of the other person on the other side of the room is an actor, but if they were willing to do what they thought was literally shock another person to death because that was the instruction of the experiment, and we're talking like 2/3 of people are willing to do this, that understanding of human nature has to inform when we're looking at something, when we're reading something, you know, and we also have to understand, you know, historical precedents, right? Like, we weren't allowed to talk about myocarditis or blood clots, but now they're being acknowledged, you know, and right now we're not, you know, not necessarily allowed to talk about cancer. Right. But it's.
Well, and that's part of the problem, right? Is a lot of the conversation about, shut down. And I think that's a big part of the problem too, is that so much of the conversation was shut down during this time. And so we couldn't talk about these, we couldn't ask these questions.
Or even note these things that, you know, and Ben Goldacre has a good, I think it's Ben Goldacre who's a good saying. He's like, if you get enough anecdotes, it's data, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a,
yeah, the logical Catholic here is saying that I agree that we shouldn't blindly trust a scientist, but if a randomized control study shows a clear result, I'm compelled to believe that, even if it goes against my intuitions.
Well, my answer to the logical Catholic, because I'm apparently like getting nowhere actually talking, is please go read Bad Science by Ben Goldacre. Just please go read Bad Science. Actually, some of the chapters in that are pretty bad, but read Bad Pharma too then. You know, because this idea that the randomized controlled trial is like the gold standard. And in a certain sense, it is the gold standard of research.
Conducting research.
There are, I could list a dozen different ways, he does in the book, to throw off the results of a randomized controlled trial. Okay, just one, I'll give you one example. All right. So you want a 5% confidence interval, or 95% confidence interval, right? If you are looking at a drug and you want to make sure that you get good results for this drug, if you look at more than 20 different outcomes, statistically speaking, one of them will have a 95% confidence interval. So like.
So could you expand on that? So 20 some different outcomes. So could you list some idea, like what does that mean practically? Like what kind of outcomes might you be looking for? And then one would have a 95% confidence interval.
Yeah. So if you're looking for, you know, something like a blood pressure drug, you know, you might look at blood pressure directly, but you might look at all these things that are related or interact with high blood pressure or low blood pressure or indicative of, you know, and you're looking at 20 different physiological markers in terms of proteins that are being produced or circulating in your blood or actually just good old fashioned measuring your blood pressure. You know, if you're looking at 20 different outcomes, you're likely to find one that's going to give you a positive result. And if you just report that one, then you've got a positive trial. And if you have a positive trial, then you can get published and then you can get drug approval. And so, but that's just one way. You know, another way is looking for surrogate outcomes. They did this with the HPV vaccine, right? So you're looking for a surrogate outcome, which instead of actually tracking cervical cancer, they tracked a certain kind of lesion in the cervix, which often resolves on its own. This also sounds like polio. Everything goes back to polio. But you know, if they're tracking the resolution of a lesion that normally resolves on its own, that the data that they did to determine efficacy of the HPV vaccine doesn't mean anything, and it doesn't matter how randomized or controlled the trial was. You know, and so those are the things that we need to be aware of. So again, can't cover this whole thing in a podcast, can't cover it in a soundbite. Please go read Ben Goldacre's books, the Bad Pharma especially, because Bad Pharma will be directly related to clinical trials. And then read Turtles All the Way Down for fun, because, you know, they talk about the same thing in the beginning of their book. So.
Oh, and the logical Catholic says, thank you for entertaining my questions. God bless you both. But no, thank you. And I've appreciated some of the pushback that we've gotten. I think these are great questions. And I'm not an expert. And I'm not going to pretend to be one, not even
on my podcast. I get called an expert.
Well, but I mean, you have a great background for talking about this. And often it is the quote unquote known experts. I'm thinking of like Robert Malone and some of these other people who have been pretty deplatformed. I mean, they're not allowed to have these conversations. And again, we need to have these conversations. We need to be iron sharpening iron so that we can hopefully draw a little bit closer to the truth. Claire was wondering too, and this is a little bit off topic a little bit, but are flu shots linked to greater autoimmune disorders?
So that is something I'm currently investigating, and the jury is not completely in on that. Now there's, you know, we could again go over the whole process of biological mechanism whereby vaccines can cause autoimmune disorders, and they've been demonstrated to do so. They've been demonstrated to cause autoreactive cells in mice, and then those autoreactive cells in some people will develop into full-blown autoimmune disease and other people won't. But the link specifically between the flu vaccine and autoimmune disease is something that again, I have like a file full of papers on the flu vaccine, because the flu vaccine is particularly interesting to me because of its high level of side effects and its low level of efficacy. And then of course the repeat, you know, the boost and boost and boost and boost effectively when you end up getting this season's version and next season's version and next year's version. And also because of the problem of original antigen extent, which I just find really fascinating, because if you're going to vaccinate for something that's as changeable as the flu or as changeable as COVID, then you've got a spectrum of antigens, right? We might've talked about this last time, cause I don't remember who I tell what, but if I vaccinate for this one and I get infected with this one, it's as though I never got vaccinated because they're just too different. But if I get vaccinated with this one and I get infected with this one, which is a little bit different, but not quite different enough to mount a whole new immune response, my body will mount an immune response, but it won't be effective. Mm-hmm. And so I will actually get sicker than I would have if I hadn't gotten vaccinated in the first place. So that's the most of what I know about the flu vaccine. The direct connection with autoimmune disease is something I'm still working on.
That's really, really interesting. And one thing that I know you were excited to talk about, and I want to give you some time because this has been a lot longer than I anticipated. And I really want to thank you for spending so much time. This has been a really interesting discussion. And I know a lot of people have enjoyed this, but myself included, I love talking about this and I love your politically incorrect takes. but one thing I want to talk about was getting all these vaccines, and we talked about the aluminum found in these, and a lot of people are interested in finding ways maybe to detox from having received some of these vaccines, because there are going to be things residing in your body that were used in these vaccines. So would you mind talking about what you discovered?
I can talk a little bit about aluminum, because I had a gal email me. I met her at a conference, and she emailed me a week ago maybe, and asked about her grandson, who appears to be vax injured, but he was after the MMR 2, and there's no aluminum in those vaccines, but he did receive two other vaccines that had quite a bit of aluminum in them. So, you know, I said, well, on a natural level, you know, here's what I found. And I was reading a book by Dr. Christopher Exley, who's been working in the field of aluminum in biological systems for like 30 years. And so his colleagues call him Mr. Aluminum. Like anybody who works in the field, like that's how he's known, because he just knows so many things. He's done so many studies. And I found it really interesting that they did a couple of different studies where they took people who had heavy body burdens of aluminum. So they were measuring a lot of aluminum so they measure it in urine, just because it's the easiest way and most accurate way to measure it. Hair doesn't give quite as good a measurement. And there was one other way that they did that doesn't give quite a good measurement, but they're measuring their body burden of aluminum by the amount of aluminum they're excreting. Mm-hmm. And they had two different studies, they had people drink silica rich water, because Exley had noticed when he was doing his original work for his thesis, and this was his only research that got published in Nature, because after that it got politically incorrect to publish his research. But he noticed that at one point he was doing experiments in fish with aluminum toxicity, and he noticed at one point that having a lot of silica in the water, which kind of happened accidentally, I think, actually kept them from dying from what normally would have been a toxic dose of aluminum. And he was scratching his head, and of course, the biological mechanism is still isn't perfectly established, but he thinks the silica is actually binding the aluminum, rendering it inert, and then you just pass it out. Hmm. But he did studies with people where he had them, he measured their aluminum output for like 12 weeks, and then for 12 weeks he had them drink water that was rich in silica. Now, silicon or silica supplements don't do this. It's water that where the silica has naturally dissolved in situ, like at the place that the water was actually flowing, that actually helps with this. And people only had to drink like a liter to a liter and a half of this water a day, which is not much at all. And they noticed that they excreted significantly more aluminum. And in both people with Alzheimer's and MS, they started to see some reduction of symptoms. Now, in the Alzheimer's paper, it was only in 20% of patients, but they were only running that one, I think, for like 8 weeks, not 12 weeks. The MS patients, they ran for 12 weeks. And then again, anecdotally, but enough anecdotes make some data. One of the women in the MS study continued to drink the silica-rich mineral water long past the end of the study, and her MS stopped progressing. So, wow. Yeah. So, you know, this is something that is... You know, and I am not into quack weird remedies. Usually when somebody sends me a remedy and says, this is going to help save cancer, baking soda will help save cancer patients. And I'm like, I can't tell people that. I don't think that's legitimate. But I read this, and because he has actually done two actual clinical trials of the use of this silica water, in patients and attain consistent results both times in terms of both excretion of aluminum and, you know, alleviation of symptoms. And again, not in every patient, but it was only 12 weeks. You know, you can go down to Walmart and you can buy Fiji water and you can drink a little bottle of Fiji water every day, and it might actually reduce your body burden of aluminum. And that's not an unreasonable thing for people to do if they think they might be suffering from aluminum toxicity. Like, this is one of those things where it's like, this is 100% worth a try. And there are actually studies to back it up.
So silica water, so like Fuji water or like
Fiji. So Fiji water comes from Fiji. But I have a couple of bottles over here on my shelf because I was drinking some earlier, but it contains, silicic acid, which some people confuse with salicylic acid, which is aspirin, but silicic acid is the dissolved form of silicon, or silica.
Interesting.
And people use the terms kind of all interchangeably, and the Fiji water is high enough in it that it could be clinically relevant. There was another water that I looked at that was high enough in it. It was a Hawaiian water. It was like Waiakea or something like that, which you can also get at Walmart, I think. But these are things that are very easy to obtain at your average grocery store. Not that like I'm a super huge fan of Walmart, but if you can find it at Walmart, you can probably find it anywhere, right? So, so this was just something that I was like, you know, if you have, you know, a child who's had a lot of aluminum in vaccines, if you feel like, you know, you're having situations, you know, because aluminum is neurotoxic and it can accumulate in your brain because it can cross in the form it's used in vaccines, it can cross the blood-brain barrier, and it's used in the hepatitis B vaccine, the pneumococcal vaccine, the DTaP, there's another one I'm forgetting, HPV. And curiously enough, I'm manually going through Bayer's data right now, all the way back to 1990, whatever. And just looking at just strictly numbers of incidents per vaccine type. And all the ones that I just named that have aluminum in them have extremely high counts of various reports. You know, and the Bayer system, as we discussed earlier, it's a broken system. It's self-reporting, it's underreporting. There's no case studies being done in these individuals to determine exactly what the you know, progression of the disease is, or the pathophysiology that's involved. You know, it's just somebody writing in and saying, I had a vaccine and then I had a reaction, or you know, I got a fever, I had an injection site reaction, I you know, and there's about 160 deaths per year up through about 2010, which is what I've been, how far I've gotten so far. That skyrockets when you get to 2021.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. The number of deaths that are reported to VAERS, post the introduction of the COVID vaccine versus prior to it. So Anyway, that was a long, rambly explanation. Be like, if you think that you may have been aluminum poisoned, you should try some Fiji water.
Well, and if you are concerned about aluminum toxicity, then should you maybe avoid using, like, we have a question here from No Ads. Mm-hmm. They're wondering if we should be avoiding using aluminum foil on our food and stuff like that.
Yeah. So aluminum foil can cause aluminum to accumulate in your food. It's going to be more likely if you're covering something that is acidic in aluminum. So, traditional wisdom is you don't cook tomato sauce in an aluminum pot because you're going to have aluminum laced tomato sauce. Mm-hmm. I don't use aluminum foil. I don't use aluminum containing deodorants. Aluminum has also been implicated in breast cancer, and my grandmother passed away from breast cancer, and I've never had children. So I'm at high risk for eventually developing it. So I stopped using aluminum deodorants a long time ago. So you can absorb some off your skin. It's unclear how much is absorbed through your gut. And it's also unclear exactly how much aluminum foil is going to be, or aluminum is going to be absorbed into the food from aluminum foil. I would be more concerned about avoiding things that are packaged in aluminum that you have no idea how long they've been sitting in the aluminum. Mm-hmm. So like the Tetra Pak kind of stuff, where you've got the tightly sealed aluminum and even things that are in aluminum cans. So soda is actually a big problem because it's in an aluminum can. The aluminum can is coated on the inside to protect the very acidic contents from touching the aluminum. But any tiny imperfection in that very thin coating brings the aluminum directly into contact with the soda. And this is one of the things that Dr. Exley was talking about in terms of his recommendations was basically just like anything in aluminum cans is acidic, but don't do it because technically, you know, they do take precautions to make sure that you're protected. But unless you're in a clean room, which is it's way more controlled than a laminar flow hood. You know, unless you're in a clean room where there's like no dust particles, no anything, you know, there's a chance that there's going to be some contamination from dust as that coating's getting on the aluminum. That's going to disrupt the coating. That's going to cause the aluminum to come in contact with the soda. And that's going to be a dose that you're not going to really be able to determine. It's not like one particular kind of soda is worse than another, or one can of soda is going to be worse than another just because of the nature of accumulating particulates. So that's something I would avoid. Aluminum foil, you know, again, I try not to use it. Just as a precaution, just because we live where we're going to be exposed to aluminum. So I'm not going to choose additional exposures to aluminum. But again, like I said, I'm at a high risk for breast cancer, and that's been implicated. Aluminum's been implicated in that. So if you have familial Alzheimer's, you should be more worried about this. If you have autism in your family, you should be more worried about this because it actually has done a lot of studies looking at brain tissue and aluminum in brain tissue, and he's found extremely high amounts of aluminum in Alzheimer's and autism brains. So you know that would indicate that you know that because both of those things tend to be genetic, although there's spontaneous cases of both. You know, if your family has a genetic predisposition to this kind of stuff, you're going to want to be even more sensitive to avoiding it. So,
wow, that's a lot of great information. Thank you so much.
That's my layperson's recommendation. I'm not a doctor who's medical advice.
Yeah, thank you for adding that little
talking about Exley's research. So.
Well, thank you so much. Do you have any updates or news on what's going on at the Colby Center?
Sure. So we did, I might've mentioned this last time, we did receive sufficient funding to cover most of my salary for 2024. So I get to stay employed, but I'm still fundraising actively, both for the Colby Center. If you make a donation there, if you mention my name, that would really help me out. Or at the encouragement of my boss, I also started a GiveSendGo, which is
crowdfunding. Can you send that to me?
Yeah, I can send that to you.
Thank you.
Me. Sure. Absolutely. I will happily share with you ways that people can help me out. So unfortunately the Colby Center fortunately and unfortunately, my boss is amazing. And he has chosen to shoulder the burden of the medical bills that my health sharing plan did not cover when I went to get treatment for my ankle in October. And so there's about $4,000 of medical bills that did not get covered. And that is now being covered by donations that are being made to me or to the Colby Center. So, that's beautiful and providential, but it adds an additional $4,000 to the total burden that we need to raise. So, and you're speaking of spiritual warfare before the talk, my car died in the church parking lot, and it's still sitting there and has to get towed. And I don't know if it's reparable. So,
oh no.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, everybody. We got it. We got to help Pamela out. Okay.
If ever there was a time that I was in need of charity, it would probably be now. But I do know that God provides, and I've been so blessed to be on this. You know, so we started a kind of a capital campaign for just to keep me on, back in November. So I got notified in October that there wasn't sufficient funding to employ me full time next year, which would be this year now. And then we started just asking people like, Hey, can you help? You know, I have been absolutely overwhelmed by the generosity of the people that have responded. And, I wish I could thank them all personally, but I don't know who all of them are. It's just been really beautiful. And it's really beautiful to be part of something where, you get to really live out the spiritual life. I don't want to borrow Father Ripperger's words too much, but you know, you talked about exorcism being the Catholic life writ large, you know, and I feel like a lot of times my work is the same way, because I talk about things like, abortion tainted pharmaceuticals, and I talk about things like creation and evolution. And these are things that there's a lot of, spiritual components to what you do and don't believe and what you do and don't do. And, the devil doesn't like these topics, to be talked about in the ways that God likes them to be talked about. And so there's just a lot of, there's a lot of suffering that's involved in our ministry, for not just for me, but for everyone that I work with, everyone that I know that has worked for the Colby Center has suffered quite a lot. You know, there was one year where all four of the employees ended up in the hospital with major stuff, kind of like back to back to back. The flip side of that is that you see God's providence, and you see people is kind of coming out of the woodwork to be charitable and to help and to be part of what's going on. And it's just beautiful. It's really just beautiful when you're able to believe that, you know, that God really meant what he said, you know, and when he said that all things work for good for those who love God, he meant that. And when he told us that, you know, seek ye first the kingdom of God and I'm going to take care of the rest of it, he meant that. And I've just seen that in my life over and over and over again. You know, like I chose to leave the lab because I didn't want to work with the Board of Fetal Cells. And so I don't have a job at Pfizer, and I don't have a career in vaccine development. And thanks be to God, I don't, you know, thanks be to God, I don't. I don't want to be involved in all that evil. And the plan that God had for me was so much more beautiful than anything that I thought out. And, you know, in terms of the stuff that we're working on at the Colby Center, we're coming up into our big spring travel time. So I'm going to be at some conferences around the United States, which is going to be a lot of fun. And we're putting out, we just put out a new book on, it's a collection of poetry, I think, that my boss wrote. And another book that's actually a novel that one of our colleagues wrote. So we've got some fiction as well as some nonfiction options available now. And I'm just plugging away. So
that's really cool. Thank you so much for coming back on to Integrated today to talk about this. And thanks for all of you guys who came on and listened and pushed back and asked really great questions. I love that. And I appreciate it so much. It was such a fun interview to do today. Thank you guys, and God bless all of you.